720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here in the lovely Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Kind of overcast today, but it's still nice and warm, so I hope you're enjoying the warm weather while we got it, because we all know that fall and winter are just right around the corner, my friends. We all know it. Like it or not, we know it. Plenty of stuff to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We have a big show planned for you. You know, lots of people are taking Uber and Lyft and all the rideshare stuff. I know we've talked about that a lot on this show. We've certainly talked about Uber a whole lot. Well, there's a really interesting piece in the New York Times about how Uber is looking this first half of 2016. And you know what? It does not look as good as you'd think. There's a lot of loss attached to that. So here to talk with us about why that might be is the author of that piece, New York Times reporter Mike Isaac. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us on a Saturday. We appreciate your time. So tell us about this piece that you wrote. We have talked about Uber quite a bit on this show, and the headline grabs you right away. The headline is how Uber lost more than $1 billion with a B in the first half of 2016. And that is really, that's quite a headline. That's quite a number. Talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah, so Uber is, I would say it's a company that is not afraid to aggressively spend money in order to grow to as big of a company as it possibly can. So they have, to put this in context, they have actually raised something like $10 billion, $11 billion in their lifespan. I think it's probably more than $11 billion at this point. It's kind of hard to keep track. So they have this huge war chest. But if you're a company like Uber and you're fighting other ride-sharing companies like Lyft in the United States or Grab in Southeast Asia, or there's something called BlaBlaCar in Europe, if you'll believe that, you need a lot of money to set up fronts in every country. And so in order to make money, as they say, you have to spend a whole lot. And that means they spent, I think, some $1.2 billion this year, in the first half of this year, just setting up and expanding as fast as possible in a lot of these countries.
Certainly. And so, you know, there's been a lot of conversation lately, I know certainly in Chicago, but in other cities as well, about, you know, that seem to kind of threaten the position that rideshare companies are in. You know, I know also Uber has had the added layer of some not great press over the last couple of years of incidents with drivers and accusations and things like that. And how does that usually play when we look at numbers and you know, is it by quarter connected to incidents like that, or is it kind of longer tail?
I think Uber, so this stuff costs Uber in a few different ways. One, they have to, when you get on the ground in a different city, you know, as you guys know in Chicago probably, the regulations are already sort of against them. There are strong unions, there are sort of existing safety regs and things like that are sort of put into place. So Uber will have to spend a great deal of money just getting a team on the ground there to do lobbying and to sort of drum up a lot of interest. Now, something they have that works to their advantage is if you've ever used an Uber, it's actually pretty convenient and like a good service, right? So they can get this sort of grassroots support right away. But then the other half of that is, like you said, they have bad press. They have these incidents, whether it's, you know, assaults that occur on behalf of a driver, or, you know, they've had some sexual assaults, and they have to deal with a lot of sort of lawsuits that come up in the wake of that. So that's settling. That means sort of dealing with a lot of these court cases, and that's state by state. So that stuff just adds up over time, you know. But I do think we've hit a sort of tipping point, and I don't see this really going away. It's just a matter of Uber really balancing their finances in the long term to make sure they actually become profitable at some point.
Right. And so when we talk about those startup costs, because indeed, Uber has never been afraid of investing heavily, what is it that they're building right now? Where if we were to break down that $1 billion, what is it really going to right now?
Sure. So here's the sort of caveat in the first half of 2016 losses. So for a very long time, they were fighting a war in China, where Travis Kalanick, the Uber CEO, his big dream has been to do what no real other American internet company or technology company has been able to do, which is crack the, you know, the billion plus people that live in China and offer his service there. And the problem was that meant spending tons of money, upwards of some $50 million a week, subsidizing these rides to get people using Uber, and also fighting this other dominant service in China called Didi. And that just, frankly, that proved too costly in the long run. Investors were not comfortable spending that sort of money on a market that may not even prove to be a win for them. So last month they pulled out of China, they sold off their business, and now they the long-term effect of that is there will probably be fewer losses in the next quarter. So that pain has been with them for the last year, year and a half, but I think it's going to get better in the coming months at least.
Well, it'll be really interesting to watch all of that. And then what do we, when we look forward, because they've like this example, they've had, you know, they've hit some snags with their global expansion. Do
sure.
we have any sense of kind of what they're aiming at next and what's on the horizon for them?
Yeah, totally. So the latest news is they actually just made a $700 million acquisition of this company called Otto, O-T-T-O. And what they essentially do are automating self-driving trucks. And so another sort of potential line of expansion is for Uber to upend the trucking industry and see if they can make ways in there. So there are a number of like adjacent businesses that Uber has sort of aspirations to break into. Now, again, who knows if they can actually upend that stuff because it took them a very long time to sort of break into transportation in general. But if they do, there's a ton of upside because that's a whole other multi-billion-dollar industry. So I think that's what you'll see right now in the near term. And then, of course, there's delivery, there's food delivery, there's all these other sorts of areas they want to play in. So even if they're not going to win China, there's a whole lot of other room for them to expand.
Yeah, I think I've been thinking a lot about that. The other day I was in an Uber and the driver was also a Lyft driver and also a Grubhub delivery driver. Also, I mean, all the apps you can possibly do, I think he was running them kind of all at once. And he said that's really the way to, you know, where you start making, you know, better money is when you're working all of them kind of at the same time. So I thought that was really interesting. It's an interesting thing. And what I think is also very interesting about Uber is how it's become like Xerox and Kleenex, right? People, even when they, you know, mean something else, it's kind of shorthand for rideshare. And it's even stretched out to when we talk about other things, we say it's the Uber for this. It's the Uber for pet sitting. It's the Uber for this.
Yeah.
Which I think is just really interesting and really a testament to their branding.
Yeah, I'm curious if it becomes the thing they have to worry about. Sort of like you said, you know, Kleenex sort of is a catch-all term, but it also becomes commodified in the long term. And you wonder how you differentiate yourself from these other competitors. Now, I think Uber is large enough that they can do what some of these losses have been a result of, which is subsidize these rides in order to drum up demand, and then that sort of like returns bigger business and eventually profits. But I do wonder how you avoid this sort of becoming a commodity in the long run, and I think that's something they have to work on as well.
For sure. It'll be really interesting to keep an eye on this. Well, we will keep turning to you, Mike Isaac, reporter at New York Times, for all Uber and more, all of the latest. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and spending part of your Saturday with us. We are most grateful to you for that. My friends, you know what is endlessly fascinating to me? Well, many things, but one thing that I find so interesting is when we look at different data sets and try to kind of correlate data with events. I think that is so very interesting, and we do that a lot on this show. But there was a piece in Bloomberg recently that was maybe stretching it too far, but I thought it was darn funny and wanted to talk about it. It is essentially looking at the correlation between what Jared, the jeweler company, you know, that everybody says, he went to Jared, right? That one. Jared is saying they are making a connection between the number of people getting engaged, and so I'm assuming they're measuring that by number of engagement rings sold, with the election. They claim that Trump and Clinton are scaring couples from getting engaged. Their idea being that when the economy seems stable, when life seems stable, when things seem stable, people are like, yes, I want to do this and commit my life to my partner. But when things look uncertain, not so much. People tend to, I don't know, leave their options open or they don't want to commit. I don't know what it is. But that's a really interesting parallel being drawn there by Jared. So we shall see if engagement ring sales go up after the election. And it would be interesting, too, I think, to look at past elections and see if you know, jewelry sales did similar things during election cycles, especially ones that are quite contentious like this year's.
Do you sense them not taking full responsibility, maybe?
Absolutely.
Like maybe, I don't know, maybe it has something to do with your business. I don't know.
Right, maybe people don't want to go to Jared.
I'm definitely not an expert, but a piece of anecdotal evidence. My brother got engaged last night.
Boom, in your face, Jared. Right.
So, yeah, that's proof that they are wrong.
Well, so I would offer another piece of completely anecdotal and non-scientific, but we're going to call it WGN science. Like, good enough because we're hypothesizing it on the air. But there was a story I read recently about how Etsy and like, engagement rings and bridal stuff is going way up on Etsy, and people are wanting, like Kristen Bell was talking about how she paid, I don't know, $100 for this outfit that she wore when she got married. And somebody, another celebrity, was talking about she got her rings off of Etsy for, you know, $90 or something. And so I think there's also a trend to people want that. You know, that there's that push to have like an artisan thing or a special handmade kind of thing, something widely roasted on Portlandia, right?
Yeah, like
artisan light bulbs.
Converted barn for the right. Ceremony or something like
right.
that.
Right. People want this kind of, you know, which I love. I mean, I think people roll their eyes at it and sometimes I think it is a little silly when, you know, you're just buying a package of sliced turkey sandwich meat and it's like artisan. Like, no, it's not. It's made in a factory and we all know it. But I think it, to me, it's the pendulum swinging back from a huge, huge mass production push, you know, like mm-hmm. after World War II, everything went to mass production. And I think people are craving that kind of handmade quality thing. I think that's why local food and organic food and the craft beer. And I think that's why that's appealing to people right
and
now.
And weddings are seeing that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. You think so?
Yeah,
that makes sense to me.
I mean, my cousin is a jeweler and she gets a lot of custom orders for rings and, you know, and she's had kind of steady business, but it's gone up for her in the last year or so because people want something different. They don't want just this same old thing. They don't want their rings to look like everybody else's. They want something kind of special and weird.
So you think maybe that is more responsible for Jared's troubles in this year or this summer wedding season than,
certainly, say,
the election?
Yeah. I mean, also, do people get engaged during wedding season? I think that's when they're not getting engaged. Because then you're stealing someone's thunder.
I don't know. Yeah, that's true.
I think it seems
maybe
like,
that's why you do get engaged.
Right, to steal thunder. Right. Like maybe if you did it at a wedding.
Are they not getting engaged because they can't agree on who should be president? Is that
the
issue?
Oh, maybe that's a good point, Bob. That's a good point. Maybe it's like,
I
love Trump.
Understand.
I love Hillary. No.
Yeah. Why else would it stop?
Somewhere? I mean, that would be, I think that would, especially this particular election, it being so contentious and divisive, I think if a couple could not agree on the presidential candidate at this moment, I think that might be grounds for breaking up, not just not getting engaged, right? If you I would love to meet a couple who one of them really loves Hillary and one of them really loves Trump. I would love to meet that couple.
They would be able to deal with a lot of issues very well.
They could take anything.
Or that, just not care about this.
Or right. They're just like, whatever, you're good enough. Let's just do this. Fine. But I mean, I know couples that like one is a Democrat, one's a Republican, but they usually are pretty closely aligned. There'll just be like a couple of issues where one is a little more right of center, one's a little more left of center. But I feel like there's not a lot of alignment with Hillary and Trump, and that's about the most diplomatic
not
way
much
I
overlap
can say that.
There, no.
I don't think there's a Venn diagram at all. At all. I can't think of a single issue where there's
neither
overlap.
Can I. But was that wasn't in the article I saw about this. It didn't mention that couples are disagreeing
no.
over president.
Well, I'm sure they're not. Who knows why? This is you know, I would love to. I demand from Jared the jeweler a bit more information because it could just be people are over the commercials.
And you're trying to sort of prove a negative, right? Why is something not being sold? That's a difficult thing to.
You can come
provide.
Up with data for anything
yeah.
if you want to. I mean, you could also just say, "Hey, we had a really crappy quarter." You could also
it's really
just
actually
say,
only a theory at this point, not anything beyond that.
I think it is interesting, though. So head to Bloomberg. Check this out. I think it's kind of a funny, interesting thought, because certainly we can find anecdotal evidence to support any theory, right? Any of us can. And so it's kind of a funny take that Jared the Jeweler is doing. All right, my friends, let's take a little break, get you to news with our good friend Bob Kessler and all that good stuff. And when we come back, we have plenty more to talk about, including we have some White Sox business information to discuss that is quite urgent, I do believe. All right, my friends, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. We are most grateful to you for that. My friends, still there is tons to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Lots of things to talk about. All the things, really. You know, but we must discuss something about the White Sox. A lot of us call U.S. Cellular Field a lot of different things. There are some people who say, I don't care, I will always call it Comiskey. Some people say, I will call it what it is actually named. Some people, you know, we all have our thing of what we call that park and all of that good stuff. But you know what? It is, it's got a new name, and it's not sitting well with people. And here to discuss that with us is reporter at DNA Info Chicago, Kelly Bauer. Welcome to the program, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
So people are pretty mad because this new name is Guaranteed Rate Field, and people are not feeling that. And I've seen quite an uproar on social media. People are not pleased. So talk to us about what in the world is going on.
Yeah, so, I mean, I personally usually call it Sox Park. On Thursday, or Wednesday, actually, it was announced that the Sox would be changing the name from U.S. Cellular Field to Guaranteed Rate, which is a national mortgage lender.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I am a Sox fan, and I always say Sox Park because that kind of does it. You know, that covers it. That covers everything. Although I do find myself saying the cell if I know I'm around if I know I'm around only Cubs fans, I don't know why I do that. Is there anybody that seems on board with calling it Guaranteed Rate Field other than the people from that mortgage company?
You know, I would say most people were actually not fans of the name change. I'm seeing a lot of people who were saying, just keep calling it Sox Park or just keep calling it Comiskey. And then on Twitter and on just a bunch of social media sites, people started suggesting all kinds of crazy nicknames.
Most of which we can't repeat on the air.
So. Yeah, some of them were a little out there.
Some were quite funny. I was looking for it. I was digging into social media. I could not find one person who said Guaranteed Rate Field sounds like a great idea. I couldn't find one person that did that. And, you know, it's interesting because fans feel a great deal of ownership of their sports teams and the things attached to them. And people get, I mean, I just like a good game. You know, I'm not going to flip out and throw a chair over the name of the park, but nonetheless, it doesn't really roll off the tongue. I will admit that. And so I wonder, you know, is there any chance that there could be, you know, enough backlash that it might turn the tide, or will people just simply refuse to call it that?
I have a feeling that people will just come up with a nickname and stick with that. I know that when U.S. Cellular Field, when that name came out, people weren't the biggest fans of it. But eventually you kind of just get the nicknames like the Cell, which is hung around. And I know that for Guaranteed Rate Field, the Sox have said that's going to be around until 2030 and maybe even longer.
Yeah. So the CMO for the Sox was kind of absent on social media while all this was going on, but seemed to kind of take it in stride, right? He finally did make a comment, and it just kind of sounded like, hey, I'm glad people are having fun with this, but onward. He didn't seem like he was losing sleep over it or treating it like much of a crisis, really.
Yeah, he said that he got a good chuckle out of it, which I can understand. Some of the names were funny. I was a big fan of Berwyn Stadium at Fenguly Field or Malort Field.
Malort Field was one of my favorites, too. I love that. I loved Malort Field. That's very, very funny. Well, and so there was a poll up at dnainfo.com asking people what they call it. What was the clear winner?
By a long shot, the winner was Comiskey. We had more than 1,700 people who voted, and more than 50% of the voters chose Comiskey. And after that was Sox Park.
That's really interesting. See, I'm a little torn on Comiskey, and I understand why people say that, especially people who grew up here. I didn't grow up here, so if you grew up calling it that, it's hard to get out of the habit of that. But I know some people who say Comiskey has kind of a point of order as like a political statement, right? That they're like, I don't care what it's called. It will forever be Comiskey to me. And that's what they say. And that's what they plan on always saying. And which I find also a little troubling. You know, I think not troubling, but, you know, it feels like digging your heels in and kind of refusing to accept the reality of, you know, a name change.
Yeah, and you know what? I see that with a lot of kind of landmarks in Chicago, like the Sears Tower. Nobody wants to call it Willis Tower. Or the Bean, nobody wants to call it Cloudgate. It's kind of like once we find a name that suits us, we don't want it to change.
That's true. It's all about shorthand and the easy thing to call it. And I mean, you know, it's hard to break a habit. It's hard to get people to change, and a lot of people don't want to change. And I think especially when sports are involved, and especially if it's a team you have rooted for since childhood, I think there's something a little threatening about that, about suddenly having to call it something different, about change kind of being thrust on you. So it is a really, really interesting thing. So the choices on the poll that you gave, it was it open-ended of what people call it, or was it a multiple choice?
It was multiple choice, and we had the G rate, which we were hoping could be a nickname for guaranteed rate.
I like it.
That only got 8% of the vote, though. but then we also had Comiskey, Sox Park, and then we gave the option for something else, and we asked people to kind of comment what they would suggest. And we actually got a bunch of comments there if people wanted to chime in. A lot of people who were saying, call it the giraffe, call it G rate. Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
Oh, the giraffe. I suppose that'd be one way to do it. Well, if there's one thing I know that the internet cannot be trusted with, that is naming things. If we will all recall a few months ago, a European company asked for a boat, for the internet to name a boat. And that boat ended up being called Boaty McBoatface because you cannot trust the internet to name anything. So I applaud you for having that write-in option. I'm sure there were some really interesting things in there. Well, I think it may be the G-rate, maybe the GRF, who knows what we'll call it. But nonetheless, it is now guaranteed rate field. Like it or not, that is the reality of it. So thanks for very much for breaking it down for us. Kelly Bauer, reporter at DNA Info Chicago.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and be back in here just a bit. And we're going to talk about some really interesting things going on in the realm of music and how recording companies and digital, you know, there's another wave of digital disruption hitting the music industry. But just this week, it did so in a very interesting way, and it was powered by the artist. So we'll talk about that here in just a bit when we come back on 720 WGN.
Ooh, no, I've been thinking about you. You, no, I've been thinking about you. Do you think about me still? Do you? Or do you not think so far?
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us today. We're listening to Frank Ocean. That is a song from his first album. And he has done some interesting things this week. So I thought we would talk about him a little bit because in the age that we are in, suddenly, it's very exciting, right? Because suddenly, working in any kind of artistic medium, broadcast, can suddenly, you know, there's a lot of power in their own hands to release their own work. You know, a lot of people are podcasting. A lot of people are, instead of waiting to get a studio deal to make a film, they're releasing it on YouTube. They're doing it themselves. There's a lot of power in the artist's hands right now. And Frank Ocean recognized that and did a really, really interesting thing this week. So joining us right now is Natalie Robamed, a writer at Forbes, to talk with us about what Frank Ocean pulled this week. Hi, Natalie. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Well, thanks for joining us on a Saturday. So it's very interesting because it seems like Frank Ocean did a really creative move that is rather unprecedented as far as I know, but his recording label is really not very thrilled with him. So can you kind of break it down for us and explain exactly what he did?
Yeah, so basically at the end of last week, he released you know, what at first appeared to be his long-awaited second album called Endless, the visual album. And that album fulfilled his contractual obligations with his label Def Jam, which is a division of Universal Music Group. But what he then went and did 2 days later is release Blonde, which is just straight music album. And that he released absolutely independently on his new Boys Don't Cry label. It's only available for streaming on Apple Music and via iTunes. So essentially that has cut out Def Jam entirely from that second, arguably more lucrative album, which is expected to, really sell quite a lot.
It's really, really interesting. So to rewind a little bit, he released Channel Orange about 4 years ago on his label. And then there's been a lot of anticipation for this second album. A lot of people really were looking forward to it. He became very popular very quickly. And then here it comes. And what he does is he releases this album that is largely visual. I mean, it kind of looks like a long music video, really, to sort of fulfill the contractual obligation that he has with his label, and then just, I think, days later releases this album Blonde on his own label, which is really interesting. It's a really interesting move because Blonde is doing really well. I mean, it's certainly anecdotally, certainly the fans are talking this way. This is on social media. It certainly seems to be playing as if he really put the most creative work, and not that either album is subpar, they're both quite good, but in the one that he self-released, it seems like he put a lot of effort into that and people are gravitating to that piece more. And so I think would it be fair to say that his label, part of their angst is they feel like they're missing out on this suddenly, quite popular album and these album sales and this revenue?
Oh, absolutely. And it's still hasn't been utterly confirmed, but there have been rumors that UMG, Universal Music Group's head, sent out a memo saying that they were no longer going to do these kind of exclusive streams with Apple first. Because I think what really is another important aspect here is just how important Apple has become to the music industry. Whereas you might have once wanted a label for distribution and for reach, Apple Music and iTunes can now provide that. They have both the hardware in their iPhones and the software, like in Apple Music, to make sure that your album can get out to millions and millions of people.
Right. It is really interesting. I mean, I think we probably saw the first wave of music disruption, we probably saw the first wave of that back in the Napster era, and a lot of people realized, okay, we need to change the business model, and instead, as artists, we need to make money from touring and from merchandise, not so much on album sales. But then I feel like there's rumblings that have been coming, and I think a lot of artists are really struggling with what it means to release music digitally. And I think there's been a few iterations of that. I mean, I think what Radiohead did several years ago was rather pioneering. And to this day, people still say the Radiohead model, meaning they release the album and said, just pay what you can, pay what you want to pay for it, which I think is interesting. But now we seem like we're in a new era where there's both artists really concerned with, like being on Spotify, where they're saying, hey, you got 200,000, plays on your song. Yeah, but I made, $500 on it. That's not that big a deal. They don't feel like they're being compensated for it. At the same time, we're in this time where there's more power in the hands of the artist. So do you see that we might enter a time in which the role of the record label might have to change to adapt to what the reality of music is?
I mean, I think it already is. I don't think that labels are going to be redundant anytime soon. I think it's also really important to note that all of the major labels are stakes in the streaming companies. So they already have a kind of skin in the game of streaming. I think what is interesting for the consumer is that we've just seen a lot more alternative release strategies. I mean, 2015 really was the year of just surprise albums, these kind of albums that you've been waiting for just coming out of nowhere from your favorite artist, whether it's Drake or before that even Beyonce. So I think it's actually just a really exciting time to be in the industry.
Yeah, indeed. Well, thank you so much for helping us make sense of all this. It's going to be interesting to see the longer term, ramifications of this move from Frank Ocean. So I appreciate you helping us to kind of break it all down. Natalie Robmed, writer at Forbes. Everybody head to Forbes and you can read about this particular thing that she wrote. Thanks so much for being with us today, Natalie.
Thanks for having me. All right.
All right, my friends. So I think that is really kind of an interesting, take, right? So that the fact that we are in this kind of moment with the music industry that we're in, and I know her phone was a little garbled, so we had to say bye to her. But I think that's those are good points that she made, right, Griffin? That most of the labels do have some kind of stake in the streaming services, which is interesting.
Yeah, and they've really been conjoined with them. I think. Maybe hesitant to do that at first, but they felt like they had no choice because that's the way that the industry is going, that these event releases, surprise releases that get the most attention, they want to be a part of that, and they need to team with streaming services like Apple Music right. or Tidal in order to get that kind of attention. And in this, I think this is one of the first instances where they've really seen that not go their way. They were all about this exclusive streaming with Apple Music for Frank Ocean's Endless album, which came out 2 days before the independent release of his other album called Blonde, which is going to make way more money.
Yeah, and so of course they're mad.
They're feeling spurned by it big time, and it's pretty shocking that he did something like that. It's very, because we know that the industry is changing and artists are finding different ways to take power into their hands, but this is not a way that we've really seen before, I don't think.
No.
Releasing two albums...
In a week.
In a weekend.
Right.
Over like 72 hours.
Right.
And one, I don't think that the label knew about the album that was coming. Maybe they had an idea. I'm not sure.
Well, and kudos to him. I mean, I feel like there are no secrets anymore, right? It's so hard to keep something quiet, especially if you're pulling a coup of that caliber. It would be so hard to keep that quiet.
And it's possible that they did know. I mean, there were probably signs because he did pay back something around $2 million to the label before the release of this album, that they spent on recording for what would later be independently released by Frank Ocean called Blonde. He repaid that money so that he wouldn't have to worry about recouping their expenses and that he could release it on his own. So they probably thought that was weird.
Sure. Right.
I mean, I don't know what those conversations were like, but they must have been like, well, okay. Usually what we do is we make this back later, but right. if you want to give it back to us now, okay.
Okay.
And they probably knew something was going on then, but it's still, it's a move that, you haven't seen much of before.
I kind of love it. I mean, I'm not going to call this an underdog story because I don't think he's an underdog, but I love the kind of David and Goliath stories. I really do. And I love that. And I love when people... But I mean, we talk about this a lot on this show, right? We see often these smaller, nimble organizations because they're small, because they are operating in a different space. They've approached it differently. They're able to topple these giants and or at least keep them up at night. Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he is one man.
Right.
This is the kind of move. And you mentioned Radiohead, that only a really well-established artist can make. So you do have to have a certain size about you in order to make the Radiohead model or do something like Frank Ocean has done. Make it profitable for yourself.
Yeah.
Small bands...
They couldn't do it.
No, and they do feel spurned, I think, probably by the situation they're in right now. Even though you can get people to listen, you're not going to make much money until you get to that level. But it is interesting to see, one artist sort of really shake up a whole... set of systems.
I said in the kind of the timeline of music innovation, I started it at Napster, but I think really we should back it up to Bowie because of David Bowie had that's still the Bowie bonds that people still talk about, and that is he at a point in his career he started approaching people to invest in an album beforehand. I mean, it was almost what people do now in like Kickstarter and Indiegogo. He was essentially asking people to put up money for him to just kind of make this thing he really wanted to make in a different and new way.
Right.
But again, you almost need that first big bump, that support from the record label to catapult you that far into visibility.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of do what you want.
It's funny. This goes back to the beginning of Frank Ocean's career. We talked about Channel Orange that came out 4 years ago. That was on the major label
right?
with that backing. But before that, he put out a mixtape called Nostalgia Ultra, which he put out while he was on the record label, but he put that out for free online because he wasn't feeling like he was getting support from the label to put out his own thing. Mm-hmm. He was working on other people's projects mostly. He was very frustrated. So he put that out on his own on the side, and that brought him enough attention that they were like, oh, okay, you know what, we will give you more. And then finally did release his debut album proper. So he's always had these confrontations with the label, and I don't think it'll end anytime soon.
And I think that's kind of the tale as old as time, right? There's the classic, I think writers go through this with their editors. I think music artists go through this with their labels. I think a lot of people go through this like, hey, you're stifling me creatively. Right, but we know what's marketable. I think there's that whole thing where people, oh my gosh, my publisher chopped this whole chapter out of my book and it's my favorite chapter because they don't think it's marketable versus, you know, the same thing you always hear about artists being in these contentious conversations with their labels. And it's interesting that now it's playing out in a way that, and we live in a time where if you don't agree with your label, you can just go, all right, fine, I'll go do my own thing.
Yeah, it's over. End of conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. So that's why I asked our guest earlier why, if she thought that the role of the record label would go away or change or something, because it seems like they may need to adapt, because it used to be if the artist was unhappy, they're free to go and fade into oblivion. But now they can, in fact, go do something that's quite profitable and make some money and do something really interesting and powerful creatively. And so the labels are going to have to change to keep them around. It'll be interesting. We'll keep talking about this. I always love to see slices of industries that I have no part of to look at them because it is really, really interesting, all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes of the music that we listen to. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, get you over to King John, all that good stuff here in just a bit on 720 WGN.